We welcome back to the program Jen Thompson with the Bedford Museum and Genealogical Library. Hi, Jen.
Hi, how are you?
We're doing well. It's good to talk to you again. We thought, after talking to Dave McCormick with Beale's Brewery, and of course the name is from the Beale Treasure,
correct,
that we get Jen on from the museum to talk about the Beale Treasure. And so you're going to be the first guest, I think, that I've ever asked to have part of the interview with your back turned to me so I can read. Because Jen has on her Beale Treasure t-shirt, and on the back is the legend of the Beale Treasure. So I'm going to read that. I thought it would be, although Jen, you probably know it by heart, but all right, a little bit more. In 1818, Thomas J. Beale, while hunting buffalo and bear out west, found gold and silver. In 1821, he buried the treasure somewhere in Bedford County, Virginia, devised a 3-page cipher, and left it with Robert Morris. If he didn't return, Morris was to receive the key in a letter. Neither Beale nor the letter arrived. In 1885, James Ward published a booklet on the Beale treasure and the code. Since then, many have tried to find it, yet the treasure remains buried. Or is it? All right, that's on the back of Jen's t-shirt, and on the front, the Beale treasure, I broke the code and found the gold. All right, so first things first, the Beale treasure. Does it exist?
I don't know. My personal take on it, based off of research and different things, is it is either a true story or it is a fantastic piece of historical fiction. Based on Peter V. Meister's book, and he was the expert on the Beale treasure.
And he believed it existed, right?
He believed it existed as well.
Okay.
Thomas Beale did exist. Ward existed. You know, Buford's Tavern existed. I can tell you exactly where Buford's Tavern was located, because Locust Level, which was the home of the Bufords that owned Buford's Tavern, still exists. So these places, these different things existed. So it's either true or it's just a fantastic piece of historical fiction. So it's kind of one of those questions. I will tell you that when it first came out in 1885, the pamphlet did, we were doing, at the museum a couple years ago, we were doing a thing about Montville and the community.
Montville.
Of course, we have to talk about the Beale treasure. Mm-hmm. So I was doing some research in some old newspapers, and somewhere shortly after the pamphlet came out in 1885, somebody in Montville suddenly became rich. Now, they didn't tell how they got rich. They didn't say, you know, anything. They just kind of suddenly came upon some money. So there's that. I mean, then there's...
That's the third option, is that it existed, but somebody found it.
Correct.
So how much money are we talking about?
The legend says that it is lots and lots and lots and lots of money. I don't know the equivalent of today, but it was apparently wagons full of gold that was brought back. And then they were all buried in pots and, you know, cast iron type things, buried somewhere within 4 miles of Locust Level in Montville. And if anybody's familiar with Montville, it's that big plantation home. When you're first coming in from Roanoke, it's right there next to the road. So somewhere within 4 miles of there is supposedly where it was buried.
Yeah, it was just looking at Wikipedia, in excess of 1,000 pounds each of gold and silver plus jewelry. And they say that the estimate now is it would be, as of January of this year, $43 million. So it would be quite the windfall if you were to come across it somewhere.
Yes. And there are people that are still looking for it all over the world.
Looking for the key.
Looking for the gold themselves because they think that they've already broken the code. So they've taken the code, which was in the pamphlet. And Peter V. Meister's book, A History of a Mystery, actually features the pamphlet. So
okay.
It says the whole entire code of the three letters. And so they think that they've already cracked the code. So they will actually go out to Montville and hire people to dig places, whether it is in the national park or in the cemetery. And
they're not really supposed to do that, are they?
Well, no, and Judge Updike was not so thrilled with them a couple years ago when they were digging in a cemetery. And there is a case in Bedford County court history not that long ago where somebody was doing just that. So people go all the time. They go, yeah, I found it. There's even one guy online that said, oh, no, Thomas Beale actually came back to Bedford, dug up everything and brought it back to Missouri. And I've got the diaries to prove it. And I'm like, oh, this is interesting. Let's look at this. And it mentions in there about 1814 and that he got a Purple Heart. And I'm like, I don't think you did. Purple Hearts, I don't think, were out at that point. And then another entry says 1822. I took Sally to Bedford City. I'm like, no, you didn't, you liar. It was Liberty till 1890. There's not Bedford City. I was like so mad. I'm like, oh, why are you doing
fraudster.
This?
Well, if it's just a great fiction, it's just a great, somebody told a story. Somebody right. just told a tale around the campfire and just created this legend. When did that happen? I guess I'm just trying to think. Can you just make something up like this whole cloth and create this sense of mystery? Or is it the kind of thing where there could be a little bit of truth to it here and there?
Well, that's the thing, is if it is fiction, mm-hmm. it's based off of real places and real people. So it's one of those cases where it's like, it was in 1885 was when the thing came out, was mm-hmm. when the pamphlet came out. So you've got people that are going, oh my goodness, that's my uncle. I know him. I know that guy. I know these people. And it was done locally. It was done in Lynchburg. So the hotel, Mr. Ward, was based out of Lynchburg. So all of this stuff is Lynchburg, besides where it's buried, which is in Montville. So it's like, you know, you've got all these things that are close enough to being truth. And I think that's part of the problem, is that you can't, you know, if they're talking about flying purple dinosaurs, you can go, oh, hey, it's totally made up. It's all good, mm-hmm. you know. But they're talking about real people and real places that you can walk down the street and go, oh, my goodness, mm-hmm. it's right here.
And
oh,
the
my goodness.
Pamphlet, the pamphlet that you're talking about just lays out the details of the treasure.
The story.
Okay.
It lays out the details of the story, and it says, you know, in the 1820s, Thomas Beale did this. He was at Montville for a couple of days. Then he went into town and was at the hotel. And he said, hey, you know, if I'm not back for a little while, in like 10 years, read my, you know, you can open the trunk. And then 25 years later, the guy opens the trunk and goes, oh, my goodness, and sees these letters in it. He goes, well, forget it, puts it away. And then about 20 years later, he pulls it out again. And that's when Mr. Ward gets a hold of it. And he tries to crack it. And then it kind of...
So the code was in the trunk.
The code was in the trunk. So it was kind of one of those things where it's like, you know, it's been sitting in somebody's, you know, back corner or in a mm-hmm. closet for decades. And so it's like, okay, by 1885, are these people still alive? You know, are they... And another interesting thing, too, is looking at these old newspapers, is that around that same time frame, there were at least six people in Bedford County... I think they tallied up the total ages of the six people, and it was over 500 years. So in other words, it was like, you know, 90s, and, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. a lot of them were in their 90s, and some of them were in their 100s. And I'm thinking, they should have been able to go to those people and go, you know, when you were younger,
yeah.
did this, any of this happen? And I don't see any of that going on one way or the other.
Right.
So it's just kind of an interesting, is it, isn't it? I don't know. And it's hard to tell. 200 years later.
But, so what you're saying is, and your job is to kind of be in, you know, Bedford history,
yes.
is that you don't, I mean, historians don't really know.
They don't really know.
Hmm.
Because... Well, let me ask you, too, you brought up with the Purple Heart, one of the things that anything like this, you have those sort of anachronisms where the Purple Heart wasn't called that until World War One. You know, they came from the Revolutionary War, but it was the Order of Merit. And the same thing you get with some of the translation of what... Beale supposedly left, like words like stampeding, which were not in use at the time, or use of the language that didn't come until maybe like the 1880s, awfully coincidental. Do those sorts of things give you pause and make you worry this is just a big hoax?
Absolutely. Anytime. And then another thing that they're doing, too, is they're trying to translate the three letters, and they're trying to use 1885 or 2017 documents, where you have to look at what was available in 1819 when he's writing this. What is he using? What's available? You know, and one of them was the Declaration of Independence. Well, that's fantastic. That's very national treasury of you. But did Thomas Beale, frontiersman, Virginia native, out west, have a copy of that? You know, could he have really gotten a copy of that to use that as a key? And the question is, I don't think so. That doesn't strike me as something that average Joe would have known, because average Joe in the 1820s couldn't read and write. So unless he's educated, and if he's educated, then why is he taking gold and burying it in the middle of the woods?
Hmm.
You know, so it's kind of one of those questions of, okay, if he didn't have access to that, what did he have access to? And one of the things he probably would have had access to was the Bible. But then why don't you use the Bible to translate something? You know, so it's kind of one of those things where it's like, what really could they have used?
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're using things to translate, and you're going, is that really the word that you want? And then they also translate it, and you're going, is that the spelling? Like, if you're going to use it for letters, make sure that you know that double S's are F's, you know, and make sure that you're using the right, the 1820s.
Right.
Put yourself back into that time frame, not using modern stuff.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I mean, it's fascinating. And then Dave McCormick from Beale's Brewery came to you guys and found out more about the history of it and used some of the, I guess, reproductions in the brewery, right?
Yeah, like I believe so, yes.
There's the map and the... So when people... What is the code? What does it look like? What does it say?
The code itself is just a bunch of numbers.
Okay.
I mean, it's literally like three pieces of paper, and it is literally like 27, then a comma, 52, a comma, 157, then there's a comma. I mean, there's just a bunch of numbers.
I mean, is it substitution code?
We're not really sure. I mean, this legend has been around for a long time. Matter of fact, during the 1930s, when the Works Progress Administration came through and recorded history of different things, there's actually a Works Progress Administration write-up on the Beale treasure itself, you know, on the mystery. There's Bedford County's first historian was Lula Parker, and there's a letter that I've seen that's addressed to Lula Parker from from Lula Parker to, like, the National Archives, or from the National Archives. I mean, it's corresponding back and forth. Can't remember who wrote to who.
Mm-hmm.
But it was about the Beale treasure, and that was in the 1930s. So it's like, you know, people have been wanting to know this, been curious, been trying to figure this out. And it's like, I really don't know.
Yeah. So even if it's a hoax and somebody just, you know, doing this as a hoax, it would have been from the late 19th century that they did the hoax. So it's just very cool, one way or the other. So Jennifer, one more thing we wanted to talk to you about, and that is Teresa Roan's visit tomorrow night.
Okay.
And tell us a little bit more about her.
Okay. So, the Sons of Confederate Veterans that is based in Bedford is hosting Teresa Roan. Teresa Roan is an African-American United Daughters of Confederacy member, and she is an expert on African-American Confederate veterans, including her own ancestor, who was a free person of color, who was a fortress, can't think of the name, but where... enforcer, basically. Mm-hmm. He would be, you know, making the walls better and those
like
kinds
an engineer?
Of things. Kind of an engineer, yeah.
Okay.
But she has become an expert on this. So a lot of times people go, well, Confederates didn't really serve. I mean, you know, blacks didn't really serve in the Confederacy. Why would they? Well, you've got free persons of color, and so you've got some people that were born free, because the status of the mother determines the status of the child. So they were already born free, and there were a few, not very many, but there were actually a few of them were slave owners. So you got some of that going on. They actually decided to serve for their state. But you've also got some that were slaves themselves that went with their masters, that were either like personal bodyguards, almost sort of, or they became the cooks, they became the teamsters, they became, you know, the almost like the quartermaster kind of thing today, where, you know, there weren't a lot of them that actually fired weapons or that had, you know, given weapons,
mm-hmm.
because both sides were still very racist. And so they kind of didn't want to give, you know, something that they saw as inferior, a weapon to possibly use against them. But what Teresa is doing is she is collecting the data on these Confederate veterans, whether they be free persons of color or whether they be slaves, and figuring out where they served. Did they get a pension? You know, what did they do? Well, how much were they paid? And sometimes the cooks or the wagoneers or like her ancestor were actually paid really decent money, better even than some Union privates. So it's just kind of an interesting dynamic to look at it. And as far as the total number of Confederate veterans, I really couldn't tell you. I mean, as far as, you know, how many of them were African-American, I really don't know that percentage. Teresa would know, though.
Right.
Because she's worked at the Museum of the Confederacy for many years. She's the current archivist for the United Daughters of Confederacy. She's worked in different libraries and different things. And she's got her history degree as well. So she's very much into that, like, history mindset, and mm-hmm. that's kind of become her obsession.
And she's speaking tomorrow night at the museum. She's the guest of the Bedford Rifle Grays, Sons of Confederate Veterans. I'm sure the Confederate monument controversy will come up, you know, her thoughts about taking those down or what to do with them.
Actually, I follow her on Facebook, and her thoughts are keep them up. Mm-hmm. She's like, this is, you know, we should preserve our history, whether it's beautiful or ugly or whatever it is, it's still our history. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the Confederate monuments were actually put up as a way to honor the sacrifice of the veterans, no matter what color they were. I know that one of the monuments in Bedford, for example, in the city cemetery, is over 500 souls. And we only know the names of about 250 of them. So that one monument to us is going, look, there are 500 people buried underneath here that lost their lives in the town. So it's mm-hmm. kind of a way to remember those that sacrificed. Yeah.
All right, Jennifer, her speech is tomorrow night at 7. Your website for much more information about everything we've been talking about is bedfordvamuseum.org. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.